Here to dive into industry trends with leading ETF experts, this is ETF Spotlight with Nina Mishra.
Hello and welcome to ETF Spotlight. I'm your host, Nina Mishra. My guest today is Matt Bartolini, head of Spider America's research at State Street Global Advisors. We're talking about the market outlook and best strategies for the fourth quarter of 2021. Matt, welcome back on the show.
Yeah, excited to be back. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about the recent market action first. So we know that September has been a tumultuous month for stocks. And this Monday, the S&P 500 recorded its biggest one-day drop since May. And that is after the Chinese real estate developer Evergrande said that its rising troubles could lead to defaults. Now, U.S. stocks are bouncing higher today. And for the purpose of reference, we are talking on Wednesday, September the 22nd. And today they are higher as it appears those concerns related to Evergrande are starting to ease. And all this comes after a record-breaking bull run for the market this year. So talk to us about your thoughts on the recent market action.
Well, I think the Evergrande sort of noise was probably just too dominant in the market's news. Like, I don't think it was really the driver of a lot of the price action we're seeing. If we just take a look at the, you know, like a broad-based S&P China index exposure, Evergrande was only 2 basis points of a weight within that, you know, overall index. Like, it's a very small market capitalization in the grand scheme of things. And it, you know, it's one company in China, and like, it really shouldn't be that big of a surprise that a real estate developer in China, given all the sort of ghost cities that have been developed, would have significant balance sheet issues. Like, I just don't think that was roiling markets. I think it made for a very catchy news story. It's obviously very salacious, you know, billion-dollar founder and owner and you know, obviously taking on excessive amounts of debt. And obviously they had gone into different businesses like electric vehicles. So it made for a great story. I just don't think it was really the, you know, the driving force between some of the weakness in the markets. I think some of it had to do is that technically we were a bit overextended and there was a little bit of weak breath beneath the surface. You didn't have a significant amount of companies with it trading above their 50-day moving average, even though the broader S&P 500 was. You also have this sort of fundamental vacuum. You know, there's no fundamental earnings reports being released in this time period. And typically we do see a little bit more volatility when you do have this vacuum of information where maybe macro risks are driving the marketplace more. And macro really hadn't changed that much. You know, there wasn't really a bad, quote unquote, like extremely bad data print. The Fed really hadn't come out and said anything different. There was no new real developments within from a COVID perspective. In fact, COVID case rates were starting to improve and starting to be on the downslope after some of the Delta variant surges. So I think this was really technically led. The market was a bit ahead of itself. There was lack of fundamental news, and there was sort of looking for a reason to sell. And I think this is why we saw on Monday, you know, it broke through the 50-day moving average, started the test of 100-day, finding some support there. And now we've been higher over the last few days as buyers have come back in. We need to take a bigger picture and say, okay, like, earnings growth is likely to be positive, you know, perhaps near the double digits in 2022. Economic growth continues to be strong. Monetary policies, while starting to normalize in the U.S., overly be accommodative, it's still a generally good environment for risk assets, particularly when you just look over at bonds, where 88% of investment-grade corporate bonds, or just investment-grade bonds overall, have a negative real yield. So from a risk asset perspective, equities, you know, continue to be allocated to. So I would look past the Evergrande news and that spectacle and still sort of just go back and focus on, you know, what actually can impact the stock price of, say, an Apple or a Google or any other S&P 500 stock. It's highly unlikely that it's one single Chinese real estate developer that is only 2 basis points of exposure in the Chinese market itself.
That makes total sense. And I agree with you that Evergrande shouldn't be a big concern for US investors because their exposure to Chinese real estate is rather low, and but Evergrande in particular. But there are other concerns for US investors. There are concerns about slowing economic growth, and that is mainly due to the Delta variant. And then there's the possibility that the Fed may start tapering these stimulus measures very soon. And we are waiting for the FOMC statement today. We will all be reading, listening for any hints at when the Fed's bond tapering will start. So tell us, what are the biggest concerns for investors now, and what can investors expect from the fourth quarter of this year? We know that stocks are still the best place to be in, and we also know that there's a lot of cash on the sidelines, and that is why we see that buyers come in and they try to buy whenever there is a small correction or a small dip. So they try to take advantage of those bargains, because there is a ton of factors. There's no alternative to stocks, and also the fear of missing out, the FOMO factor. So that is why we see these buying on dips. But what are the concerns, and what do you think investors can expect from the final quarter?
So, you know, there is a sort of a laundry list, which I think goes back to my earlier comment, where investors coming into the last few, you know, trading days, let's say the last 6-7 days, which is sort of looking for a reason to sell. You know, markets had started to go a bit elevated in terms of, you know, technical price momentum or other sort of other measures where there's a little bit of trepidation. But, you know, in terms of some of the concerns out there, they're all seemingly connected. You know, some of it is policy normalization, tapering, low rates, fiscal spending impacts, inflationary pressures, expensive valuations, earnings growth stability, market gains concentrated around a few large stocks, and really the future path of economy that still is dealing with the lingering effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. While case rates, I said earlier, have started to improve and fall lower than they were in the last, you know, say 6 weeks, they're still high, right? We're still dealing with the pandemic and some of the effects from a society, behavioral, and an overall economical perspective. But I think when you group that all together, the through line of these conversations that we're having with clients, there are two questions. One is, how can I participate or continue participating in a policy-supported rally marked by elevated valuations, given concerns about the sustainability of future growth? And then two, where can I source real levels of income within bond portfolios that can withstand rising rates? And those are those two big questions that we're seemingly getting over and over after we talk with clients around some of their concerns. And I think with respect to policy normalization and tapering, you know, it's a little bit of calling my shot, as I see here, 48 minutes away from the Fed decision. You know, I think when we take a look at, you know, what might happen from a taper, and again, I could be completely wrong when everyone hears this, but I think it's unlikely that the taper announcement will come at this Fed meeting in September. There'll obviously be talk about it, but I don't think they'll actually give specific guidance. There has been some softness in recent labor data. There's still those lingering concerns about how Delta variant and other variants that are out there that are impacting recovery. And, you know, if we look at the options market, you know, it really hasn't sort of forecasted a lot of volatility around today's date from an implied perspective. Also, you know, when we saw this take place, and again, it's only one data point, but back in 2013, it was announced in November and activated in December. And so that's where I'm looking for. I'm thinking in November, we get the timeline. In December, we get the first action. Again, in 47 minutes, we'll find out if I'm right or wrong. And for those listening after that, if I am wrong, I can't be right all the time, I guess.
Yes, sure. So as you mentioned, most experts believe that a taper announcement may not come in this meeting, after this FOMC meeting, but it will come sometime maybe later this year or maybe early next year. And I saw that you had done some analysis of past taper performance trends. And we know that this is just one data point, but that analysis could provide some suggestions, some clarity on how various asset classes may perform after they announced tapering or after they start tapering. So talk to us about those past taper performance trends that you saw.
Yeah, so I sort of have a bit of a love-hate relationship with this data point. Yeah, I hate it because it's only one data point and it's marked in a period in 2013 where we can't really make too many corollaries to what we're going on dealing with today. So there's not a lot of robustness to it, but also I enjoy it because it's really the only data point we have in terms of how asset classes may behave when you have a taper of asset purchases. You know, there's only been one other time the central bank in the United States has bought, you know, that's not true. They bought it back in the 50s, but it wasn't really called quantitative easing back then. But in general sense, what we saw in 2013 is that small caps outperformed. They, you know, from a period of May to December 2013, they outperformed by 21%. Mid caps, you know, 13%, and large caps also 13%. Developed ex-US equities and sort of anything outside the US, emerging market equities underperformed U.S. equity markets. And I think what we can take away from that performance is that the Fed's sort of telegraphing of tapering purchases or actually conducting them reflects some of what they see in a strength of economic activity and strength of economic growth. It is a confidence in the economy. And historically, when you have this level of confidence in the economy with growth moving upward, cyclical exposures that will historically benefit from an expansionary market environment should do well. So sort of just, you know, taking back, you know, what the action is of tapering and sort of focus on the impetus for it so that the Fed feels that the economy is growing and it's expanding and that it's a conducive environment for cyclically exposed assets. That's why I think small caps will do well again as we start to have more of these taper conversations and ultimately be enacted. You know, also, you know, if no longer a big purchaser of treasury bonds are out there and they're sort of slowing down, that could have an upward impact on interest rates. We would obviously, historically, that small caps have had a higher beta in correlation to interest rates than large caps. So I think that also sort of can play into some of the similar exposure or similar exposure performance that we saw back in 2013. And the one thing I would sort of caveat all that with is that, you know, EM debt, EM equities were really hit hard in the last taper. So far this year, they're obviously not doing quite well for various reasons. Some of it sluggishness in China economic data, but also really being hit hard by the pandemic effects with the Delta variant. I don't think they'll be as impacted this time around during the taper because a lot of it was due to some of the current account deficits of some of those local nations and the usage of U.S. denominated debt. I think that's obviously been resolved, or not resolved, that's been improved. I don't think it should have as bad of an impact. Although, all being said, I would favor U.S. equities to outperform non-U.S. equities during this taper. You know, tapering of purchases. We can't call it a taper tantrum because I don't think there's any volatility. So maybe it's a taper play date, to use that term.
Interesting. And so as you mentioned, one of the most important questions that investors have now is that how they can position their portfolios. And if they believe that this stock rally will continue and because they're supported by a very, very easy monetary policy that is likely to continue. And even though valuations look elevated, the rally this year has been driven mainly by earnings growth. So valuations do not look very stretched compared to the valuations last year. And I read about a recent CNBC survey, the results of which were released just this morning, that Wall Street investors now believe that it's time to take some risk off the table as their concerns which are starting to pile up. But again, many other strategies believe that stocks are still the best place to be in. And you talked about that investors should focus on quality and small caps now. So talk to us a little bit more about your ideas for portfolio positioning for the fourth quarter and beyond. And small caps in particular, I would add that small caps did very, very well late last year and early this year, because these are companies which usually benefit from economic reopening. But they have been treading water for the past 6 months or so. So what makes you believe that small caps will outperform in the final quarter now?
Yeah, so I think broadly, valuations, you know, just to go back to that, they are elevated, right? They are trading well above their historical average. They are no way near the extremes that we had seen, obviously, in the dot-com era or even in 2019. But the market's price-to-earnings ratio currently sits in the historical 90th percentile. So quite elevated. And when you actually look at other metrics for the S&P 500, whether it's price to book or, you know, enterprise value to EBITDA, those are also trading in the 90th percentile as well. So, you know, valuations for U.S. large caps are overall extended. Now, you know, in terms of asset allocation, you have to own stocks in this environment. You know, the discount rate, interest rates, they're very low. If you look at stocks relative to bonds, so the stock's earnings yield minus the, you know, U.S. Treasury yield, still in the favor of stocks. And again, that policy environment is going to be supportive for risk taking. So you have to own equities. Now, okay, the argument then is, well, do I have to own the most expensive ones? And I think in this environment, it is beneficial to perhaps tamp down some of those elevated valuations by focusing on not pure quality stocks, but quality value stocks. You know, looking at something like a dividend yielding type strategy that only includes companies that have increased their dividend for 20 years, right? There's an amount of rigor associated with that. You know, typically, you know, those type of companies have less volatility, both from a fundamental perspective, their earnings growth are more stable, but also from a standard deviation perspective. So you're able to continue to participate in the rally. You're able to sort of potentially solve for two things. One is the valuation conundrum, where you are still owning U.S. equities, but you're now owning them, you know, in a sort of a less expensive manner. At the same time, you know, you are also able to improve the quality bias within the portfolio, because if you look at it from a factor perspective, high dividend yielding stocks, you know, that have a propensity to increase their dividend for a significant time frame, they typically load very strongly on, you know, having low earnings variability, high profitability, and that can be beneficial if we do see some weakness in some of the earnings growth in 2022, where we have seen revisions come, where it used to be around 12% expected growth, now we're around 9%, which is historically in the long-term average. So not bad earnings growth, but definitely not something that we saw in 2021, with those low base effects. Similarly with small caps, you know, if we take it from a valuation perspective, small caps, you know, while they rallied significantly in the last part of 2020 and really the first few months of 2021, as you said, they have really traded sideways, yet large caps have significantly rallied. This has created a value opportunity. When we looked at a five-factor composite metric of different valuation ratios, we found that on a relative basis, small caps trade in the seventh percentile relative to large caps over the last, you know, 20, 35 years. And so we think small caps have a benefit, or could have a benefit, in terms of a policy normalization, as we spoke to earlier, but also as a value component. And I think it also can serve to maybe tamp down some of that exposure from a concentration perspective in U.S. large caps to mega cap tech and communication services names. So now you will be adding some more volatility from that perspective, but if you're blending it with also a quality yield portfolio, you basically sort of net out in sort of the same type of volatility than standard large caps, just from, you know, barbelling those sort of two different value opportunities.
Very interesting. Now, could you also talk about some ETF implementation ideas for the portfolios if investors want to tilt their portfolios towards more quality and more small cap stocks?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously within our lineup, we have a significant amount of exposures that from, you know, a market access perspective, but also liquidity tools as well. And, you know, some of the options that we have discussed with clients, particularly the ones that we put forth in our blog posts on this topic, one is around the SPDR S&P Dividend ETF, SDY. The other is the SPDR Portfolio Small Cap ETF, SPSM. All of these, of course, can be found on our website, ssga.com/ETFs. And there's numerous other exposures that potentially could be utilized to implement these type of ideas.
And those are very interesting ideas for sure. Now, switching gears a little bit, I also wanted to talk about ETF fund flows because I know that you monitor fund flows very closely. And this has been an excellent year for ETF fund flows. We have just seen monstrous inflows into US listed ETFs because we know that investors love their low cost, their tax efficiency, and their transparency. And of course, the rising stock market earlier this year also helped. And that is why we saw a lot more inflows into stock equity ETFs this year, unlike last year, where fixed income ETFs also saw a lot of inflows. So talk to us about important takeaways from fund flows that you observed.
Yeah, I mean, very quickly, the big ones are, you know, we're at $631 billion of inflows for the industry in the U.S. That's obviously a record, surpassing the $505 billion from last year. Based on my expectations and our projection model, we're likely to sort of, again, this could change based on the market environment, but what the model is saying, we should be around $820 billion of inflows by the end of the year, which would be roughly a 60% increase from last year, which is just phenomenal. And it's really been driven by a few different things. One is just the market rally and the willingness of investors to seek to participate. Equity strategy have taken in $473 billion, you know, and that's been, you know, spread, you know, pretty much across all different geographic segments. However, really driven by U.S. equities. There's been $306 billion into U.S. equities. All geographic segments that we track, whether it's, you know, international, developed, region, regional funds, emerging market funds, or single country funds, they all have inflows this year. But the lion's share has gone into U.S. equity funds, just given what we've seen from returns from that market. And again, you know, sort of flows typically follow returns. But there's also been really strong strength within sector strategies. Sector strategies have broken records this year, $65 billion of inflows already. And I think that speaks to investors wanting to allocate and participate in this rally, but not just in a broad-based beta fashion. They're looking to harness some of that sector dispersion that we have seen where, you know, you have some significant underperformers and outperformers based on, you know, prevailing macro data. I mean, you have energy that's up 25% and utilities that are only up 4% this year. And we've seen investors try to participate and harness some of that dispersion with sectors. I think the sort of last two points is within fixed income. Fixed income flows, while they're not at records now, based on their path and pace, they are likely to break records again. So we've had $156 billion so far year to date. That should actually equate to around $220 billion, which would be more than what we had last year. Within fixed income, I think what's, there's sort of two points to drill down beneath that surface. One is TIPS ETFs have taken in $27 billion. And that number doesn't really do justice to the movement we have seen investors utilize fixed income ETFs in, you know, really, you know, non-core strategies like TIPS to structure portfolios based on macro information. TIPS ETFs have now taken in more than $1 billion of flows for 17 consecutive months. In that time period, they've, you know, seen assets increase by roughly $44 billion. Similarly, bank loan ETFs have taken in $8.7 billion. And both of those positionings are for a higher inflationary rate environment because bank loans obviously have a floating rate coupon. And they are not as impacted by any duration-induced price declines, something we have seen within high yield. What I think is interesting, though, is that bank loans have taken in, I said, $8.7 billion this year. That is more flows this year than in the last, I think, 8 years combined. So again, investors are becoming more comfortable using fixed income ETFs in non-core strategies like TIPS, bank loans, emerging market debt, to build these asset allocation portfolios, to harness different macro trends, and to ultimately, you know, deliver on some of the investment goals for their clients.
Excellent stuff. And that's all we have time for today. Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like our show, please leave us a rating on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. And also make sure to subscribe so that you do not miss any episode. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, please email podcast@sax.com.
This material is being provided for informational purposes only, and nothing herein constitutes investment, legal, accounting, or tax advice, or a recommendation to buy, sell, or hold a security. Do not act or rely upon the information and advice given in this podcast without seeking the services of competent and professional legal, tax, or accounting counsel. Publication and distribution of this podcast is not intended to create, and the information contained herein does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. No recommendation or advice is being given as to whether any investment or strategy is suitable for a particular investor. It should not be assumed that any investments in securities, companies, sectors, or markets identified and described were or will be profitable. All information is current as of the date herein and is subject to change without notice. Any views or opinions expressed may not reflect those of Zacks Investment Research as a whole.